My name is Lewis Myers. I'm the executive director of the Folk Alliance organization. I want to welcome everyone to Kansas City, to the Westin Hotel, for the 26th Folk Alliance Conference. And thank you so much for being here. Just a few quick announcements. Everybody is doing a great job on working in the hotel. I want to remind you, we have a full-blown music camp next door at the Sheraton, connected by the link or by door-to-door transportation at the front desk. Your badge will get you into all music camp activities. We've got some of the top teachers on the planet, some of the top players, so please, you go over there for songwriting, for banjo, guitar, dobro, mandolin, all levels from entry level to master classes. It should be a very exciting thing over there. It's our first year, so please, anybody that's not, tell other musicians that you know to take advantage of that. Other than that, I think most of you know the drill at Folk Alliance, and everything seems to be moving quite well, so thanks for being here. Right now I want to introduce a dear friend of mine, Mr. Joel Raphael. He's a board member, has been a board member and an active participant in Folk Alliance for quite some time. He's a singer-songwriter, he's a public supporter and an activist, and he's a good friend of Folk Alliance. So please welcome to the stage Mr. Joel Raphael.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Kansas City. It's a great city, and proud to have been on the board to help get us here. I'm really also proud today to bring to you my friend, our keynote for the 26th Annual Folk Alliance International Conference, Mr. Graham Nash. We've got to bring one, David Herschel up here for one quick moment. Come on up, David.
Thank you. I'm actually a little chagrined to take even 30 seconds away from Graham, but I'll do it anyway. I'm president of the Board of Folk Alliance. Thank you all for coming. It's a fabulous conference, and you're making it so. Many of you know Lewis Myers personally. Some of you just know him by reputation. Other of you have no idea who he is, but I just want to tell you, this organization, this conference would not be here. We would not be in existence without his efforts over the last 8 years. Lewis J. Myers. In recognition of his 8 years of outstanding service, the board wanted to present him with a Hatch show print, which is hopefully will hang in the Folk store down the road, and also in his palace that he's now able to afford for being 8 years as executive director. So, Lewis, thank you again for all your service.
Thank you, folks.
Thanks, Lewis. Mr. Graham Nash.
Thank you all very much. I'm very, obviously very pleased to be here. Thanks for the Folk Alliance and my friends Joe Raphael and his lovely wife Lauren for inviting me to speak. I came from Hawaii, so it was quite a journey. But it was well worth it, definitely. Also got a friend here, Barry Orman, who's a record I sang on recently, as well as singing with Joel. He came from Denver. Barry, how are you doing out there? I have a few thoughts, and it's several pages, but don't worry, it's in large font and double space. So. The truth is that we're really troubadours, going from town to town, you know, letting people know that the emperor really has no clothes, and that
I think we have a duty to pull back the curtain and reveal the wizards that are controlling our lives. We definitely do that, for sure. And for me, it all started with the Weavers and Pete Seeger, of course, Peter, Paul and Mary and Woody Guthrie and Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan, etc. We've always tried to speak truth to power. We've never made it 100%, but we're trying to shorten the distance between the public and the truth. But one thing we must remember is that we all have our truths, right? Stephen still thinks it was in Cass's kitchen that we first sang together. He's completely wrong, as me and Crosby keep telling him all these years. So you've got to believe me, I'm a really lucky man, and it seems to me that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And unfortunately, that's not true for the majority of the people. So forgive me if I speak my mind for a long. I've always felt it to be a personal responsibility for each of my songs and the songs of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young to have a reason for existing, a kind of raison d'etre, if you will. I've written my own many, many Moon, June, Screw Me in the Back of the Car kind of songs in my life, when I was with the Hollies anyway. But today it's much different, of course. I think musicians have a solemn duty not to waste your time. Time is the only currency that we really have, right? I don't want to play you a song where you just go, I mean, what's the point? I don't want to waste your time. You know, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Mark Zuckerberg and even the Koch brothers, even with their combined fortunes, can't buy a fucking second of time. So let's make sure that we leave here and use our time wisely. It's very difficult for me to tell my kids just how fast life goes. You know, I'm 72 years old now, and it seems like the blink of an eye. You know, so let's use our time every second as wisely as we can. There are many politicians who continue to disappoint us with their policy decisions, and we must find a way to deal with it. And perhaps public financing of political campaigns might be one of the ways to go. I know that there are many good politicians in government, but many of them are bought and paid for, and their decisions affect our very lives, millions of us that are affected by this. In my humble opinion, I think that the American people should reverse the Citizens United law given to us by the Supreme Court. And if you don't know what that is, that's the law that allows our democracy to be bought and sold for by the person with the biggest TV budget. And also, you know, a lot of the corporations that rape our earth for their own personal profit and allow millions of dollars, most of which are given in secret, to be able to mold the political landscape to their own corporate advantage. I really believe, and I have all my life, stick up for the underdog, to stick up for the common man, because life is a very difficult goal to live, as you know. And the ever-expanding gap between the haves and the have-nots is shameful. Shameful in this country. I recently found out that I think 85 people in the world have more wealth than 3 billion of us. How much is too much, you know? How much is enough? When you have the Koch brothers who are worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, and we all know that, you know, taking care of our families is cool, but how much is enough when people are starving on the streets, you know? Why is it that breadwinners of families just trying to take care of their kids and trying to, you know, take care of their families, why is it that they have to make a decision between rent and food and medicine? This is America, for God's sake. Why is it that they can't even make a living wage? Yes, we just increased the minimum wage, but it's still not a living wage. You know, some of these people have to work 2 or 3 jobs at once, you know. That puts an enormous strain on families, as you probably know. I truly believe that the American public is being brainwashed. And as long as bread and circuses rules the day, As long as media keeps us concentrated on Justin Bieber's monkey or the size of Kim Kardashian's ass, you know, we're in grave danger of never getting to the root problems that are facing us. I became an American citizen over 30 years ago because I didn't want to be the kind of person that was lobbing, you know, grenades from the side. You know, I wanted to be a part of this country. This is a fantastic, beautiful, wonderful country that you have here. I see it differently than you do because I'm English. I see it differently. This is an incredibly beautiful country full of hope and optimism. But there are some people in this world that don't want it that way. They want it their way. And we have to deal with this. So I'm very pleased to be a musician and be able to speak my mind because this is America. I can speak my mind. You don't have to listen, but I can speak my mind, right? So America is a very beautiful place, you know. Even what you're watching on CNN and Fox News, it's still a beautiful place, and let's not forget that. Music saved my life when I was younger. It actually saved my life, and I'm very glad to be here alive and kicking. We've always wanted our music to be compelling and intriguing and to touch people in deep and emotional ways. We all know that the music business has changed radically in the last decade, but music is what we do. It all comes back to basics. You have to start with a good song, right? And one of the things we mustn't forget is that music really has a great power to influence hearts and minds and to actually influence history. I mean, Woody Guthrie knew that, and Pete Seeger certainly knew that. Reverend King also knew that. As musicians, we always try and be alert to what the universe puts in front of us, and I try and keep my eyes open to the ways that will touch my heart and my soul so I can not waste your time. You know, that's what allows us to speak truth to power, and that's what allows us to get away with our real stories about love and life and war. One thing I can assure you all of is that me and my partners will continue to speak out for love and for life and speak out against the status quo and the problems facing us today, even at the risk of retaliation from greedy corporations that have a stranglehold on this society. I send you greetings from David Crosby and Stephen Stills and Neil Young. Long may our freak flag fly.
Well, Graham, since you've been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice, you're an officer of the Order of the British Empire. You've been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame twice. And for over 45 years, you've been singing with a decidedly rock band. So how do you find yourself here among 2,000 folkies?
We're all in the same business. We're all musicians. It doesn't matter if it's a rock song or a rap song or a folk song. Who cares? Does the song change your life? Does it make it better? That's what we're in the business of, right? We're in the business of communicating, right? Isn't that what we're all doing? That's why I'm here.
You mentioned the Weavers. Can you tell me some of the other early folk music that you were exposed to when you were a kid?
There was a lot of music I was exposed to as a kid. Big Bill Bruzy, for instance, Miles Davis, the Louvin Brothers, and then, you know, the Everly Brothers, and Buddy Holly, and Elvis, and Jerry Lee Lewis, and Fats Domino, and, you know, all the fantastic rock and rollers. And one of the things that I thought about when I was inducted into the Hall of Fame was, I mean, we never got into this business to make awards. We got in this business to get laid. I joke, but it's almost true. And one of the things I thought about were the people that were already in there, the brilliant musicians that preceded us into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We're just a link in a chain, a long, long chain that stretches back probably to whoever it was beating on a log in a cave, you know, a million years ago. We're just a part of a chain. And to see it moving forward is thrilling to me. I saw recently a YouTube video of a group called Darlingside, who are performing here, I think, today. They were doing a song that Joni wrote called Woodstock, right? A very incredible interpretation of that song. So my point is that it will always move forward. Pretty soon, you know, this physical body will go wherever the physical bodies go when you die, and younger musicians will take over. You know, that's the way it is. That's the way life is. I'm so glad to be a part of it.
And I was recently saw a bit of newsreel footage that featured you as a young man when you were still in the Hollies, and you were having a conversation with Peter Noon of Herman's Hermits. And in that conversation, you were trying to convince him that music and musicians, through the medium of music, actually could control the world, I think is what you said. You said, we have the power to change the world. It was a quick clip, but you said something about being able to stop wars before they happen. It was pretty heady stuff, and it must have been in like 1964 or 65. But it seems like you've always been an activist, even since you were a young man. How did that happen?
I'm English. My country was almost bombed out of existence twice within 80 years. It's a different way of growing up. God forbid it would have ever happened, but if America had been bombed like London and Manchester were bombed, you'd have a different opinion about going to war so quickly. So my point is... when you grew up in the time when you didn't know whether your house was going to be there tomorrow, you didn't know whether your friends were going to be alive, you have to get on with the job. What's the job? Let's do it with the most dignity and the most fun that we can. Let's get the job done. A lot of people say, well, aren't you the glue that keeps, you know, CSNY together? I mean, fuck that. It's, we got to get the job done, whatever it is, right? Until my dying day, I'll be trying to get the job done, whatever it is that I think my job should be.
So did you, just curious if you ever convinced Peter Noon that, you know, you could change the world of music, or did he remain opposed to that opinion?
I don't care whether Peter changed his mind. You know, I said what I said, and, you know, hopefully he did change his mind, but do I really care? Not a bit.
How can we, as writers of folk songs and folk style music today, make a difference? What are the kind of issues that writers in the folk world should be focused on?
Holy shit. That's a long, 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 long list.
Well, I've always felt that, you know, and I think a lot of people in this room feel that folk music is connected to the issues as a genre of music, you know, that's one of the things that separates us from other genres of music in a certain way.
I know, but don't, you know, be careful there. Don't separate yourself from anything, you know. I'm a human being. I get up in the morning, I take a breath, and I realize, you know, by looking in the mirror that I'm still here. I don't recognize that person in the mirror, but I'm still here. And I'll get on with life. I get, you know, I check the news, I check my friends, I check the internet. I try and keep in touch with what's going on in the world because it affects me and it affects my children and my grandchildren. It affects us. It changes our lives. That's what I was talking about politicians earlier, the decisions that they make. I mean, it truly is a house of cards, isn't it?
You know, you've got a great book that just came out called Wild Tales, and of course, you know, we've got some of those books, and you're going to be doing a signing later, but, I just want to mention also, you did a recording, you did a reading of your own book, which is great, so it's also available on tape. But in your book, you describe, well, there's a lot of things in that book that are quite interesting, but one of the things that I found interesting is when you had a meeting with the Queen, and there were some conversation rules and guidelines that you'd been given, you know, before you met the Queen. You mentioned in the book that you sprinkled some of your mother's ashes in the garden at Buckingham Palace. And I was hoping you might share some of that encounter. And you know, it seems like she kind of let you know that you had been on her radar, didn't she?
I'm sure that if you were given the honor that I was given by Her Majesty, they obviously don't want to be embarrassed. They obviously check up on exactly who I am before they ever do this. There's no way in hell that the Queen didn't know what I'd been involved with politically in my life. There's no way. Because, you know, the people that protect her don't want to find out whether I'm a child molester or a sex addict or a drug user. I mean, they check you out. Of course they do. So it was a very interesting experience. And what Joel was referring to happened actually several years earlier. Crosby and I were playing at Carnegie Hall. Here's basically what happened. You were supposed to do what your father did. You were supposed to do what your grandfather did. And if going down the mine or going into the mill was good enough for them, well, it's good enough for you, lad, get on with it. But my mother and father never allowed me to fall for that gold watch theory. That's the theory where you work for a company for 50 years, and you get to a certain age, they retire you, they give you a gold watch, and they replace you with somebody younger and stronger and cheaper. But I never was allowed to fall for that. 2 years before my mother died, I asked them why she supported me when I was obviously going in a different direction than most of my friends. I had a passion for music, and she recognized that. And she told me something that absolutely blew my mind. She said, I wanted to be on stage. I thought I had a nice voice. I thought I had something to offer. But World War II came along, I married your dad, we had 3 kids, it was over for me. But you're living my life. And me and Crosby were at Carnegie Hall doing a show. And Crosby, for some reason, had to leave the stage for a couple of minutes. And so I'm left talking to the audience. Hey, how about those Mets? Yeah. And I decided to tell them the story about my mother. And I'm telling her, you know, the story I just told you. And at the very end of it, I put my hand in the right-hand pocket of my jacket. And I pulled out a pinch of my mother's ashes and I sprinkled them on the stage at Carnegie Hall. And every single place that we played that I think my mother would love to have sang at has her ashes on it.
That's really beautiful, Grandma. I saw you do that once, and it really warmed my heart up, because when you did it, you said, have a great show, Mom.
Really, I wouldn't be here except for my parents. They taught me well. Yes, get me a pen.
But did you break protocol when you met the Queen? Was there something a little different about how you...
Well, you know, I vacillate between two opinions. One, what the hell are kings and queens? I mean, seriously, right?
Right.
On the other hand, she has the genetic information in her body of a thousand years of royalty. And you have to respect that to a certain extent. I must tell you that when I actually went up to you know, when it was my turn to be honored, I told her, I said, this was the only protocol. I said, you're not supposed to talk to her until she starts talking, right? But I blew that one right away. And I said to her, I said, Your Majesty, you know, you look fantastic. I mean, you've got to understand, she's an 84-year-old woman, but she looked alive. She had a twinkle in her eyes. She had an emerald on her jacket that was the size of an egg. You know, it's like, she looked fantastic, and I told her so. And there's this thing that she does. When she takes your hand, if she makes a slight move to the left, you're gone. If she doesn't, that means she wants to talk to you a little. And she talked to me. One of the questions she asked me, she said, and how are the Hollies doing? And I said, Your Majesty, I'm sure they're all doing fine, but with all due respect, I've been gone from England for 45 years. And quite frankly, I didn't know that anyone was watching. And she looked me right in the eye and she said, and now you know.
Well, again, in your amazing book, you explain about the type of songwriting you heard when you first came to Los Angeles, and that you had a feeling of not being able to go back to writing just pop songs for radio, and it was a catalyst for your move from England to California, which included leaving multiple relationships behind. It was a time of great upheaval and change for you, and I think Many of us felt the insecurity of those times associated with leaving a known path and forging ahead into uncharted territory. And that takes courage. But what was it like for you not to not only leave your parents and your friends and family behind, but also your country, its customs, and come to America? And how has that influenced your songwriting?
It was very easy for me. A lot of people say, wasn't it difficult doing all that, leaving your bank account, leaving all your friends and your band and your, you know, I was getting divorced at the time, so leaving your wife and leaving your parents and your sisters. And I say, absolutely not. I'd heard what me and David and Stephen sounded like. I'd heard that sound. And you're all musicians, so you know exactly what I'm saying. I had to follow that sound with my heart. I knew the very night that we first sang together in Joni's living room, it was obvious to me what I had to do with the rest of my life. Whatever sound Crosby, Stills, and Nash has vocally was born in less than 30 seconds. David, after dinner, tapped Stephen on the arm and he said, hey, play Willie that song that we were just working on. And they sang a two-part, a song called You Don't Have to Cry. It was on the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, a beautiful song. And they got to the end of it and I said, wow, Stephen, that's an incredible song. Do me a favor, sing it one more time. And they looked at each other and they shrugged and they sang it again. And they came to the end of the second time and I said, all right, bear with me. One more time. Play it one more time. In the first two times that they sang it, I remember every word. I watched their body language. I watched the way they breathed. I watched everything. And when I put my voice with theirs, we had to stop the song. We had to start laughing. It was ridiculous. I mean, think of that vocal sound. And it happened not after months or weeks or years of rehearsal. It happened within 30 seconds. I had to follow that sound. So it was a very easy decision for me. I mean, I had regrets. I mean, Alan Clark had been my friend since I was 6 years old, you know. Leaving him behind was painful for me. But I had no choice. You have to follow your heart. Your heart knows what's good. And your heart knows what's bad. And I've always taken the path that makes me feel better. And that this instance was no different. I wanted that sound. I wanted those songs. I wanted this vocal blend. I wanted to change the world. And I knew that we could do it small, even in a small way. You've got to understand, the momentum of this planet is insane. And to move it a microsecond, a micro degree, takes an enormous amount of work, but it can be done, no doubt about it.
I'm going to jump backwards just for a second because you mentioned Alan Clark, and I had the pleasure of meeting him in New York when you were there. In your book, it was really interesting to me about when you met Alan, and you had a similar experience with him when you guys sang together. Was it in a choir or something, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well,
how were you guys?
I was at school one day in Mr. Burke's class at Oxford Board School in Salford, which is a very small town outside of Manchester. I was reading USA Today yesterday. No, the New York Times. The LA Times, actually, on my way to the airport. And I saw that in Salford, and that shocked me, that this word Salford, which is where I came from, right, was on the front page of the LA Times because they've started fracking in Salford, of all places. It blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. I'd known Alan since I was 6 years old. We started singing together in the school choir and assemblies and doing the Lord's Prayer and stuff like that. I mean, well, I'm not so sure I should admit this, but we actually did minstrel shows in blackface when I was a kid, when I was 11 years old. I mean, incredibly politically incorrect right now, but, you know, who knew in the early 50s But I've been singing with Alan a long time, and it was one of the things that was most difficult for me when I left, was leaving my relationship with Alan behind.
And when you came here, you took it a step further and actually applied for American citizenship. Why was it important to be a citizen?
I didn't want to be a hypocrite. I didn't want to praise this country. I didn't want to criticize this country without being a part of it. Where's that at? So, Stephen and my wife Susan came with me to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles when, you know, with me and 1,500 other people. Half of them couldn't speak English, but that was okay. I was so proud to be an American citizen where I can actually speak my mind. And after the ceremony, you might not know this, but Stephen still took me to a place called Pink's, which is a hot dog stand on La Cienega Boulevard. And that's how I celebrated being an American citizen.
Well, we've just come off of a time of year and a season that's full of award programs, including the Grammy Awards, put on by NARIS, and NARIS, of course, supports the wonderful Music Cares Foundation. I was just wondering what your take is on award programs and that kind of thing. If you ever won a Grammy with one of your groups, and what is the best attitude to promote among young musicians towards awards and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's just to get it.
I'd agree with you.
It can't be a real part of your life. The only thing that you should be doing is writing from your heart. And if you do that, everything else will follow. Yes, we won a Grammy for Best New Group of 1969.
Well, you were.
But it's meaningless. Yes, it's nice to get awards. Of course, it's nice to be recognized. It's nice to be encouraged. But it's meaningless. These awards are just meaningless to me. They really are. Although I did like talking to Queenie.
Well, that's an insight I'm glad to hear you express. From a practical standpoint, you know, and from a health standpoint as a performer, you're out on the road for months at a time. It's brutal traveling. You know, people know that here because a lot of people are out on the road a lot. What are the things you do? How do you protect your voice? Are there techniques you could share with aspiring singers about how to take care of yourself, take care of your voice, that kind of thing when you're
I take care of myself. I eat reasonably well. I have three kids and a grandchild, and my son Will is expecting twins in July. I kind of take care of myself. I haven't really had any serious illnesses in my life. I very often feel like I'm this brain on a stick, you know. I'm just traveling through this world, looking at everything, trying to look 360 degrees, trying to find, you know, the diamonds in the shit, you know. I don't do anything to protect my voice. I don't. I mean, I wish I could tell you some secret or something, but I can't. I've always sung high, you know. In 1992 in Toledo, Ohio, the phone rang in my hotel room, and it's very unusual because I'm always under an assumed name, you know. But the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was Phil Everly. And he said, I said, Phil, I'm in Toledo, Ohio. What are you doing calling me here? He said, well, you know that place that you and Crosby and Stills are going to play tomorrow? I said, yeah. He said, well, we're playing tonight. Would you like to come down to the show? And of course, I'm a huge fan of the Everly Brothers. Yeah, I met them on April 22nd in 1960 in Manchester after one of their shows. And then 6 years later, they were recording some of our songs. It was actually in 66, the Hollies were playing the London Palladium, and Pete Seeger was the headliner that night, actually. The phone rang, and it was Phil Everly again, and he wanted to know if we had any songs. We went down, you know, as the Hollies to their hotel, and we sang them songs, and we started recording an album they called Two Yanks in England. But in 1992, when I went down to the show, after soundcheck, you know, we had our normal rubber chicken dinner, you know, and Don looks across to me and he goes, so what are you going to sing with this? I'm fucking dying. It's been my lifelong dream, right? So I said, I'm trying to be cool, you know, I go, so sad. I love that song, So Sad. We could do that. So Phil looks at me and he goes, okay, I'll go underneath Dunn, you take my part. And I said, why? He said, because I have the high part. I said, Phil, you taught me to sing. You stay exactly where you are. I will sing on top of both you and Dunn. I have a board tape of me singing three parts, So Sad, with the Everly Brothers and their band. It knocks me on my ass to this day. I wanted to pay them back. I wanted to show them what their music had meant to me. I wanted to be good. You know, I have a huge ego. You know that I wanted to be good. And this cassette is so fabulous that a month and a half before Phil died this year, I called him and asked permission to use that on the electronic version of my autobiography, Wild Tales. So if you pick that e-book, you know, the extended version, you'll hear me singing So Sad with the Everly Brothers, and it makes me smile to this day.
That's a great story. I know the Everlys were a big influence on you, but your group with Alan Clark was called the Hollies, and that was named after Buddy Holly. You told me I saw you right after you had a chance to visit Buddy Holly's home, and you were quite inspired by that. Could you talk a little bit about your influence by Buddy and how you felt?
Well, Buddy Holly was one of us. He wasn't shaking his ass like Elvis. He wasn't sexy like that. He was one of us. He was a nerd. He had glasses. I mean, he was an ordinary-looking guy, but he was an unbelievable musician. He actually died around my birthday, which was February 2nd, in England, in 1959. And me and Alan Clark were on the street corner actually crying our eyes out because we had lost a hero of ours. 50 years later, I was invited to go to the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa, which is the last place that Buddy Holly ever played before he got on the plane and crashed, of course, with a Big Bopper and Richie Valens. And to stand in the snow, in a blizzard, at that part of this field where the plane had gone through the fence was insane to me. When I was crying on the street corner in Manchester in 59, I had no idea that I would become well known and I would have the career that I had. And the juxtaposition of that and standing at the exact spot where Buddy died was incredibly emotional for me. He was very important to our lives, and I think to most rock and rollers in England at the time, he was very important. I mean, Paul McCartney will absolutely admit, I mean, they called themselves the Beatles because Buddy had the crickets, right? And Crosby called themselves the Birds because of the crickets and because of the Beatles. They misspelled it, of course, but that's Crosby. You never could spell it.
We just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Beatles. You just mentioned their performance on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. A lot of hoopla about it. And in your book, you talk about an invitation that you received by Paul to come down to Abbey Road Studio in 1967 to participate in a live broadcast of Our World, for which John Lennon had written a special song, All You Need Is Love. Yeah. I always loved that recording, but hearing you describe the participants and the way the room was set up in your book, the orchestral arrangements, the spontaneous choir of Stones, Clapton, Marianne Faithfull, etc., it's a wonderful story, and I just wonder if you could tell us about that.
Well, the best thing about that entire thing is that I can hear myself whistling in the fade.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you're the whistler.
I'm the whistler in the fade, yeah. It was an incredible time. Obviously, they were doing a show that was one of the very first satellite broadcasts throughout the world, and I think the audience was about 400 million people at that time. An incredible event, everybody dressed to the nines, everybody higher than shit, everybody just having a great time, you know, John Lennon chewing gum like he always did, you know, and to sit there and watch the Beatles do that live show was incredible. They actually recorded the backing track and sang it live. So, but it was insane to be invited. I mean, you know, I'm this kid from Manchester, for God's sake. I'm not supposed to be here. You know, I'm still waiting to get found out.
And?
I don't think anybody would be able to do that while I'm alive anyway. So it was an incredible moment. I've been an incredibly lucky man, as I said earlier. I never have been a man to look backwards. I don't care what happened yesterday. I know Our House is a popular song, but my God, it was 40-odd years ago. Let's get over it, right? You know, I'm more thrilled about the song that I just wrote. I'll sing you one in a minute. I never looked backwards, but in doing this book, which I did for my children and for my granddaughter Stella Joy, who's 15 months old now, and the world, as I say in my book, the world better watch out for this woman, because she's insanely brilliant and insane person, and she's only 15 months old. But I've never looked backwards, but I was forced to in writing the book. I got to the end of my first version of the manuscript, and I turned over the last page, and I thought to myself, boy, I wish I was him.
Wow. Well, there have been some exhibits of your photographic prints in cities all over the country this past year or so, and it's an incredible collection. I had a chance to view it in New York City. You're not just a musician. You're really an artist in a lot of different areas. But tell us about your love of photography, and if you can, how you got started and interested in that. Because I would love your photographs, and I'd just love to hear you talk about that a little bit.
I appreciate that. I've been a photographer longer than I've been a musician, and I've been a musician since I was 13. My father bought a camera from a friend of his at work, and we were a very poor family, and his main joy was to take me and my sister out to the local zoo and take pictures and then develop them at home. And one day when I was 10 years old, he showed me the magic of photography. He exposed this piece of paper in what I later found out was an enlarger. It was blank. He put it into a liquid and said, wait. And I waited. He said, wait. And I said, Dad, nothing's happening. He said, wait. And after about 30 seconds, this image came floating into the universe from nowhere. And I've never lost that sense of magic. So I've been a photographer for a long time. In my book, Eye to Eye, of my photographs, my first portrait is one I took of my mother when I was 11. I like to be at the front and the back of everything. Especially. Sorry about that. I'm lucky enough to collect daguerreotypes, which, if you don't know, are the world's first photographic process, revealed to the world in March of 1839 by Daguerre, hence they're called daguerreotypes. And at the same time, I have this company called Nash Editions that makes the finest digital prints and has been since 1990. What we did was incredibly important because we started the inkjet print business, actually, and the very first printer that Nash Editions ever used is now in the Smithsonian Institute. So I like photography. To me, there's no difference between taking a good picture and writing a good song. You know, when I look at something like Moonrise Over Hernandez by Ansel Adams, I can look into the clouds and sense the violins, and I can look in the dark areas and hear the cellos playing. It's all the same energy. To me, life is this column of energy. Where do I want to plug in today? That's life for me.
I love that concept, and I love the idea of hearing one of your new songs. Are you going to play something that you've written recently for us today?
Sure. Okay.
Okay,
Okay, Sean.
This is a new song. I do write about politics and the way life is, but I also write about love, of course. I wrote this song with my friend Shane Fontaine when we heard that our friend LeVon Helm from the band had died. And having known LeVon for a while, I know that he would like us to celebrate his death in music rather than mourning. I know it's okay to mourn, of course. It's a natural process, but... So anyway, here's the song. It's called Back Home. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to embarrass the shit out of Joel right now. Because on some of our concerts that I go and attend with him, we sing this Woody Guthrie song. And I want to do it. And Joel said, no, this is your hour, But, you know, fuck that. I want to do this song, so I'm going to invite Joel to sing it, and I'm going to sing it with him. Oh.
Actually, 66 years ago, 1948, he wrote this song called Plane Wreck at Los Gatos. And of course, a lot of people assume the song is about undocumented workers, but the people that were killed on that plane, I found out recently, were part of the Bracero Project, and they were in the country legally on their way back home on contract. And so, let's do it. Dedicated the names of all these victims on a beautiful headstone at Holy Cross Cemetery in Fresno, California, where the mass grave is. The crops are rolling, peaches are rotting, the oranges are filled, and the creosote dumps. They're flying us back to the Mexican border, pay all their money, and wait back again. My father's own father, he waded that river, and they took all the money that he made in his life. My brothers and sisters come working in the fruit tree. They rode the trucks till they took down and died.
Goodbye, my one, goodbye, And long may your free flag fly.
Thank you, Graham. Graham is going to be doing a book signing right after this, over by the registration area near the merchandising area. So if you have a book on the pre-registration deal, be sure and take it over there. And I think there are some books available as well.